The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Many a tear have to fall.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. Today, no guest. Instead, I've decided to present a lot of commentaries. Commentaries that allow us to challenge some preconceived notions, all with the idea that the more we know from reasonable and responsible sources, the better decisions we can make, always beginning with the latest in cutting-edge health and nutrition, then looking at the media in America, because where do we get our information and insights and beliefs and values? More often than not, from the media. And according to Professor John Causey, we get it from Global Research, and they're selling us their views, and they're calling it news. That will be a commentary. Then I've asked for commentaries from people in the audience on issues that are important to them, both the problems and, most importantly, the solutions. Two today, can we fix our failing schools? This is a very important issue. And Christina D'Amico, an elementary school teacher with a master's in education in Brooklyn, will be the first to have her commentary shared with you, and I will post it on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. Then the downfall of science and the rise of intellectual tyranny from Mike Adams. Two commentaries from people who care about what we're becoming and have a point of view to share on that. So those are some of the issues I'll be addressing. I don't know how much time we'll get to everything, but I'll try to keep it as tight as possible. I will be asking you at different times in our program to share your points of view, and I will make time for that. So I want you to be able to call in when I open the phone lines. It won't be initially. And then tell us what you think on these issues. I'll also be giving you a coming attraction to some of the guests coming up over the next 7 days. We have some really interesting thinkers. And one of the ways that we get our guests is we look for people who have not aligned themselves with the right or left, but are rather more independent, progressive-minded individuals. So we have selected some really dynamic people. Let's begin. The latest now on health. We know we should be taking antioxidants. We've known that for a long time, because antioxidants protect us. In effect, an antioxidant grabs onto a free radical, which is bad, and neutralizes it. So therefore, the more antioxidants from more sources, the less damage can be done by the free radicals. Here is the latest from Science Daily, as reported by a review from the Cochrane Library, which is the leading group of independent scientists in the world. Quote, antioxidant supplements may benefit couples who have difficulty conceiving naturally. That's according to the latest review. The review provides evidence from a number of trials that suggest the partner of men who take antioxidants are more likely to become pregnant. Male subfertility affects 1 in 20 men. Chemicals called reactive oxygen species are said to cause damage to cells, those are your free radicals, and in particular sperm cells, which may result in lowered sperm counts and interfere with their ability to fertilize eggs. Antioxidants include natural chemicals that reduce the damage caused by that. So quite simply, when they looked at these 34 separate studies involving over 2,876 couples, they found that the men who had the largest amount of antioxidants were more likely to have proper fertilization and conception. So quite simply, there's a good example where vitamins make a big difference. We hear about drug companies having the best scientists and unlimited amounts of money. Well, that doesn't prevent them from making some bad products. The latest news is that 200 million products were recalled from just Johnson & Johnson. Quote, Just when it seemed like Johnson & Johnson recall saga had come to a close, the company announced yet another recall that includes nearly 50 million units of Tylenol, Rolaids, and Sinutab, according to officials involved in it. So this kind of puts the lie to the idea that, well, these companies have plenty of money and they can do the right thing. Yeah, they can, but that doesn't mean because they have plenty of money that they are making products we need. And there is the problem. What happens when people are making drugs that we don't need, but then they have to make sure we believe we do need it? So convince us on television that if we don't feel comfortable around people, we have social anxiety disorder, and take your antisocial anxiety disorder drug. But what about the harmful effects, the side effects of that drug? Every drug gives you side effects. Every drug. In fact, one of the effects of a drug are the side effects. That doesn't seem to be a part of any of our equations. Buying medications we frequently do not need and that cause harmful side effects, and then on top of that, the drugs are frequently dangerous when they're manufactured and have to be recalled. Separately, this is an interesting point of view. I'm sure you've all seen the cereals saying we have blueberries and strawberries and raspberries. Well, do they really? And what would be the benefit, the way they're processed at high heat and sugar on them, where the antioxidants, the enzymes, the vital life force is gone, it's dead. Not the same as when you juice a fruit, dry it without heat, and therefore have 100% living food. There's nothing living in any of this stuff. A Food Investigations mini documentary just released today called The Blueberry Deception in name brand cereals and bagels and breads and bars revealed that, and by the way, you can watch this on foodinvestigations.com, that big name food companies that offer blueberry cereals and muffins and pastries and bars have been caught, quote, faking the blueberries by creating them out of artificial colors, partially hydrogenated oils, and high fructose corn syrup. Now, this investigation was conducted by an award-winning investigative journalist, at the Health Ranger, at the nonprofit Consumer Wellness Center, which provides nutrition grants for children's education programs around the world. Now, here's the deal. Named in the video are Kellogg's, Target, Betty Crocker, General Mills, and other food companies that use artificial colors to create the illusion of real blueberries in their products. One General Mills cereal singled out in the mini documentary is called Total Blueberry Pomegranate Cereal. But a Consumer Wellness Center investigation reveals that this cereal contains no blueberries and no pomegranates. And now, you can go to the look at this up yourself under naturalnews.com and the source General Mills website. Now, the cereal does, however, contain an astonishing 8 different sweeteners: sugar, corn syrup, barley malt extract, brown sugar syrup, malt syrup, sucralose, molasses, and honey. The front of the label of the total cereal box claims 100% nutrition. After investigating the real ingredients of total cereal, the product was called, by Mike Adams, quote, a total fraud. He added, quote, it is clear to me that General Mills is deceptively marketing total blueberry pomegranate cereal by trying to deceive consumers into believing it contains both blueberries and pomegranates, two foods that are gaining a reputation as healthy ingredients in the minds of consumers, unquote. If consumers don't read the ingredients label, they may be easily misled into believing they are purchasing a cereal containing health-enhancing blueberries and pomegranates, when in reality they're buying sugared-up grains promoted with shamelessly deceptive marketing, unquote. And by the way, General Mills isn't the only big-name food company called out in the shocking video documentary. Several other companies are also exposed in the mini-documentary available. And so how do you avoid this? Simple. Buy fresh organic blueberries and put them in your own cereal. Steel-cut oatmeal cereal, quinoa, amaranth. You can make any whole grain into a cereal and add your own berries. That's what I do. And also read the ingredient labels and look for artificial colors like red number 40, blue number 1, blue number 2. And don't buy any food made with artificial colors. And don't let your kids eat foods with artificial colors. Well, I've done a program twice on Morgellons disease. And it's a horrible disease, and you would think that someone in the left or right media would do a story on it. Because if you saw someone with Morgellons, and there are people that have Morgellons in two or three places on their body, let's say it's on your chest. First, imagine a circle about the size of a silver dollar. And out of the skin are these little tiny 2 or 3 or 4 inch tentacles. And they're different colors. And they feel like glass. But, according to the DNA, look at them, they're man-made. Now, you pull one out, and it feels, according to the person doing that, who has it, it feels like someone is pulling glass out of their skin. The trouble is it grows back. And where do they come from? Wouldn't you think that with so many people having that? And a lot of people say they never had that until they had airplanes flying overhead and sawing chemtrails. Is that the connection? Here's what Hesh Goldstein has to say on this from Natural News. Quote, before getting into the Morgellons genetically modified organism link, first consider the symptoms of the disease. Itchy, burning, the sensation of mucus, Hawaiian for bugs, crawling under the skin, never healing lesions, and painful weird fibers under the skin that stick out of the skin as well. The doctors, whose pharmaceutical-funded medical school curriculum never broaches this disease, says that the people suffering from it have invented it and generally treated it with antipsychotics. However, several doctors who have dared think out of the box have discovered a pathogen known as a particular agrobacterium. Interesting enough, this bacterium is in the production of some genetically modified organisms. Farmers know it as AT as well. They are plagued with it. It presents itself as a tumor-like growth on a plant and affects corn, beets, nuts, and fruits. What happens is that the AT inserts itself into the DNA of the host plant. The GMO scientists have found a way to transfer the AT from the host plant to other genetic materials. Of the individuals exhibiting Morgellons that have been studied, AT has been found present within all of them. Healthy individuals have not presented AT infestation. A recent study at the University of Bristol stated, quote, that Agrobacterium tumefaciens in GMO suggest an alternate route by which genetically modified genes could find their way into the natural environment, unquote. What's even scarier is that scientists are seeing this AT is capable of transforming human cells as well, not just plant cells. As if that isn't bad enough, repeated chemtrail activity is being conducted over the waters of the Hawaiian Islands. And these chemtrails are dropping aluminum, barium, and strontium into the atmosphere, which are then blown inland by the trade winds. The result is the destruction of the natural plant life, but it proves ineffective to the aluminum-resistant GMO crops. Assuming there's validity to the conspiracy theory that Monsanto is out there doing some of this and knows about it, well, we haven't heard anything, unfortunately, about this from our government. They would like us to believe this is all nonsense. It is not. I can introduce you to the physicians and who are treating it and the patients who have it. This is real. And finally, fenugreek is the best way, according to this study, of warding off colds. They're saying this, that fenugreek, a common ingredient in Indian cuisine, is the winter elixir whose antiviral properties not only alleviate cold and flu symptoms, but also prevent the condition in the first place. The spice, also called Greek hay and wild clover, has been used for centuries. Now, a 3-month winter period, 20 volunteers, 10 with colds and flu symptoms, 10 without, consumed a half a teaspoon of fenugreek seeds twice a week in a curry dish. The cold-afflicted volunteers reported immediate and sustained relief from symptoms of running nose, cough, sneezing, sore throat, and fatigue. Volunteers who were fit and healthy at the outset remained the way for the duration of the trial, despite usually coming down with cold at least once in the same period. So that's interesting. And finally, curry is also good for the common cold. Here's what this says. It says that by using curry on a daily basis, you're able to have antiviral bacteria. And then this, quote, fix-all elixir, as it's called in India, is known for its antiviral properties. So they're using curry on a daily basis, and it seems to be making a difference. So what's in curry? Curcumin. So if you want a real powerful antiviral, about 800 milligrams of curcumin a day. I'm Gary Nall, back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome all of you from all over the world. I'm Gary Nall. You're listening to the number one program in the world for open-minded, progressive-minded, independent thinkers who value health and happiness. I'm concerned about the American media. From Professor John Causey, quote, America's journalists are not news hounds. They are nothing more than sales clerks, hawking the products their employers want to sell. The pretty faces that now function as most television news anchors are no different from the pretty models used to sell other products. The American free press is comprised of nothing more than a number of retail outlets which sell stories slanted to please their target audiences. As such, they exist merely to sell snake oil. Sometime we forget to pull back and ask ourselves a basic question. Where do we get our information? Could there be bias in that information? And if so, what would be the outcome? Take a look back. There was an interesting book written by a journalism professor called Freedom of the Press, Good or Bad. During the 60s, the Cold War was being fought mightily. The Soviet Union's news agencies, TASS and Pravda, were continually attacked by the American free press as untrustworthy. A common claim that was a controlled press could never be trusted, while a free press could. Well, a controlled press, I argue, most certainly could not be trusted when reporting on government actions or policies. And you have to understand that who ends up giving the press their material. An argument rested upon the observation that a controlled press, being funded by its controlling government, had no need to attract readers, while the so-called free press had to rely upon readers to remain economically viable. The free press had to market its wares in the same way that, well, a radio station, this radio station, any radio station has to. So you want to give a message, and you want people to listen to you based upon the message that you're giving. Well, the free press had to market its wares like any other retail company must. And one way to do that was to slant the news in a way that made it attractive to the news organization's target groups, which in a sense biased all the stories the free press reported. And although the free press claimed to maintain objectivity by balancing the presentation using two people of divergent political views, I pointed out that it was easy to select the two people in ways that made it seem that one side always prevails, the result being that the media divided itself into ideological groups, not even to mention that large segment of the press openly termed sensationally tabloid. Although this symposium took place approximately 30 years ago, my argument is easier to make today than it was then. The media in America too often openly declare their various points of view, from conservative Fox to liberal MSNBC, even to the Pacifica stations that you listen to now. They define themselves by their biases. Distinguished from these all-news outlets are the more traditional networks, ABC, CBS, NBC. These can be likened to department stores in which various products are sold through each day, so-called news being only one of them. These networks have their departments, the game show department, the reality show department, the sports department, the business department, the celebrity department, and, of course, the news department. What either type of medium does, however, is similar. Just as Macy's sells products of various kinds, the news sells stories, and each outlet distinguishes itself from the others by the slant in which each frames their products, just as McDonald's distinguishes its burgers from those sold by Burger King. ABC distinguishes its stories from those told by NBC. In short, in the free press, the news is sold by slanting it in ways that make it appealing to the target audiences, and the slanting often takes up more time than telling the story. An anchor often tells a story, and then so-called experts are used to embellish it by providing the slant. Unfortunately, the so-called experts used often know nothing more about the issues discussed than the average viewer listener does. The news, which many believe should consist of facts, becomes mere opinion. Everyone must remember that there is no Hippocratic oath for journalists. A person does not have to swear to report events truthfully to be a journalist. If you've been listening to this program, you certainly would see that's the case in the attack in America by journalists, from a journalist, of Andrew Wakefield. In fact, less is required of a journalist than of a plumber. You call to unstop your toilet. In short, today's American journalist can be likened to a teenager on roller skates on speed who brings the hot dog you ordered to your car at Sonic or the clerk behind the counter at Macy's. So anyone who criticizes the mainstream press for not being truthful, neutral, or objective is misguided. That's not what the mainstream press sells. And criticizing it isn't unreasonable as criticizing McDonald's for not selling lamb chops. That the media need to differentiate products from those of competitors also limits the kind of stories that can be reported. If adding a bias to a story is difficult because of the story's nature, the free press tends to ignore it. For instance, when the Iranian occupation engaged in anti-government demonstrations after the last election, the American press made much of it because the story could easily be presented as an oppressive government suppression of dissent. But the demonstrations against austerity policies taking place in Iceland, Ireland, Great Britain, Slovakia, France, Greece, have gone virtually unreported by most of the mainstream media because those demonstrations cannot be presented as demonstrations against oppressive governments. Why? Because they're our allies. Similarly, the killing of Christians in Iraq and Egypt have gone grossly underreported because they cannot be slanted to make them seem justified. Slanted in any way, they would provide anti-Americans with another reason to argue against the wars. Furthermore, it's difficult to sensationalize stories about foreigners or foreign Americans that know nothing about anything. So, for instance, stories about the antics of Italy's Berlusconi would have little attraction to American viewers or listeners. Ever since it joined Mrs. Merkel's German government, the fortunes of the pro-business free Democrats have been dramatically changed from a party that won 15% of the elections to 5% today because of an increasing negative attitude of Germans for business since the current collapse in the economy in the Eurozone. So what do we make of this? The consequence of all this is that Americans have become mentally isolated. The world beyond America's borders is amorphous, unknown as a land. As Zygmunt Brzezinski, a person I do not respect because of his pro-military and war positions, both Carter and supporting Henry Kissinger, etc., he says, quote, most Americans are close to total ignorance about the world. They are ignorant. Quote, what people don't realize is how much of this ignorance is the result of American free press and their slanting of their reporting. Brzezinski finds this, quote, unhealthy, and he is right, since America's foreign policy, quote, has to be endorsed by the people if it's to be pursued. And it's this ignorance that makes it so easy for the government to convince so many people that its disastrous policies are actually appropriate. Americans who are critical of the mainstream press have an idealized notion of what the press is. They indict the press for not being what the press should be, but is not and never has been. The press needs to sell its products to make it a viable, and therefore, in the process of selling its product, it is never going to be a free press. Unfortunately, the alternative press has adopted many of the mainstream press's models. There are sites devoted exclusively to ideological stories, conservative, liberal, libertarian, pro-anti-war, global warming, carbon taxation, and more, all in an attempt to attract readers. So the truth doesn't merge there either. There was once a small segment of the free press called investigative journalism, which has now become virtually extinct. You have no real investigative journalism in the United States in the mainstream media. Perhaps this has happened because of the difficulty of prying information out of the governmental agencies and corporate entities. About the only way to get that hidden information is to have it leaked by some whistleblower to some site that can protect the anonymity of the leaker. WikiLeaks is a start, but many such sites are needed if all the lies and disinformation is to be revealed. And yes, it is likely that governments and even corporations will create pseudo-leaking sites to try to obfuscate the truth revealed by any leaker. But if the sites can, as WikiLeaks does, disseminate actual source documents that any reader can judge the authenticity for themselves, then the truth will ultimately emerge. Slanted journalism must, of course, be debunked. And many people calling themselves journalists really aren't. America's journalists are not news hounds, although I suspect that each and every one of them will consider that an insult. There's nothing more than my thought that they are sales clerks, hawking the products of their employers. And I'm really concerned when I hear someone say they just was on the jet with the president. Well, then I know that they're going to slant a story. It's going to be a PR piece. I'm Gary Knoll. Back in a moment. Please stay with us.
There's something on my mind. Won't somebody please, please tell me what's wrong?
On board, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Don't forget, Sunday evening, 8 p.m., live over the Internet only, a one-hour program devoted to the issues that are important to you. No guests, just the audience, myself. So tune to the Progressive Radio Network, 8 p.m. If you forget that, go to GaryKnoll.com, and that takes you right there on Sunday evening at 8. We're going to go into our studio in New York City right now and say hello to Kara Lee, and then I'll be doing a commentary. After that commentary, I'll be opening that up for your calls. Hi, Kara Lee.
Good afternoon, Gary. Well, I got an interesting email from a man named Eric the other day, and he was wondering to know if you could inform him more on the context of what it means to be a patriot today, in terms of the monumental people that are affiliated right now currently with patriotism and the American flag and the Tea Party movement, you know, people like Glenn Beck and Sarah Palin. And he wants to know how people like that differ from the authentic true patriots, you know, people back in the historical context, and how they differ from then to today.
To do justice to this question, which is a legitimate question, how do you compare an original patriot, Patrick Henry, James Madison, and Thomas Jefferson, with Glenn Beck and Sarah Palin and many people within the Tea Party movement? How do you end up? Are they the same? Do they hold the same values? Is it the same sacrifice? Are they trying to achieve something based upon the same stimulation and same cause and effect? if we're to answer that intelligently and not glibly, we have to do a little bit of looking at the evolution, because everything comes from something. For example, for a long time, I couldn't get people to eat organic produce. And finally, I got the owner of Fairway Market on Broadway, which at that time was the largest produce store in the United States. David said he would take organic produce. But when he stocked the store with organic produce, about 2 months later when I went by, I said, "How's it doing?" He says, "We had to throw it all away." I said, "Why?" He said, "Nobody would buy it." He said, "I even made the organic produce lower by 50% than the regular produce, and still nobody would buy it." And I realized that what hadn't happened is that people had been so programmed into believing one set of beliefs that even something better for them would be competing against their beliefs. So you have to first challenge a person at the level of their beliefs if you're to get them to even question that something is wrong. So let's go back to 1619. That's when the Virginia colonists created the first legislative assembly in the United States. And you had the Puritans in 1620 Massachusetts. They landed on from the Mayflower in Jamestown, down in Virginia, the first settlement. And do you know what the first crop grown in the United States for export back to England was?
No.
Tobacco. In fact, over the next 100 years, tobacco and sugar would be the number one and two products that were sent back. And when you hear the word Puritan, what comes to your mind?
Original settlers.
Okay, what else?
The people who fled England for religious freedom.
Correct on both. What else?
That's pretty much it.
Okay, well, how about highly reactionary, superstitious, prejudiced, extreme bias against any other belief? It was the Puritans that ended up killing Quakers. The Puritans who held the witch trials, of which many people were hung, condemned, beaten, publicly ridiculed for being witches. And so we have to be very careful that we understand that one of the reasons that as government evolved in the colonies, there was a great desire to separate church and state, because you've heard that, right? Separation of church and state, is because the people who ran the churches or had some of the largest movements were so insensitive that they believed there was only one law that should be obeyed, the law of their religion. Therefore, any man-given law would have been second in importance to the religious law. Could you imagine having some religious zealot, as we see in Iran with the Grand Ayatollah, or that we have in the Sudan, where the president is radical, or the king Fahd in Saudi Arabia, who is a Wahhabist and believes that women should have no right to ride a car alone, or they can't work in a man's workplace, or they have to have their body constantly. Imagine what would happen in America if you had a religious fundamentalist who was president of the United States, and all members of Congress were present, were religious fundamentalists, and the members of the Supreme Court were all religious fundamentalists. We would end up being a completely controlled state. There would be only one law that would be respected, and that would be the religious law. So therefore, it was a group of individuals who said we must have separation. And there were a group of English, remember, these were English colonies, not American colonies, but they had unique American qualities. And then the rebellion started, because England was getting supplies. England would get supplies from the colonies. The supplies would go over to England. They would go to their manufacturing plants. They would manufacture goods and send them back to the colonists to buy and elsewhere. So you would send wood and you would get back chairs, until the colonists decided, why can't we do this ourselves? So they started to grow sugarcane, and from sugarcane they could make molasses, and from molasses they could make rum. So the American colonies, especially the southern colonies, like in Georgia and South Carolina, they began to sell rum, mainly to the French, and on their ships. And the English, rich English landowners in the two islands that were predominant, Jamaica and Barbados, went to the crown and went to Parliament and says, hold on a second. these colonists are competing with us. This is no good. So they created in 1733 what was called the Molasses Act. And that led to the Revolutionary War. Did you know that?
No.
Yeah, well, most people don't. But you have to look at what causes something. And then in 1733, Parliament in England put all forms of restrictions on what Americans could create and sell. And the two main products were sugar and tobacco. And that's how this started, the rebellions, you know, and then trying to hide behind this. And then another big freedom in America is freedom of the press, right? That's in our First Amendment. And the man responsible for bringing this whole galvanizing issue of what a person could print and of what a person could read without government interference was a man, he's a German-American, called Peter Zenger, Z-E-N-G-E-R. And in 1735, there was the Peter Zenger trial, and it was about the foundation of freedom of the press. And we had a really nut job of a governor in New York at that time named William Cosby. And this Peter Zenger published a little journal. It was called the New York Weekly Journal. And it was critical of some of the governor's actions. So the governor simply had to close down and brought this guy up on trial for libel. And then they brought in a man named Hamilton, not Alexander Hamilton, but a Hamilton from Philadelphia, was considered the best lawyer for defending freedoms. And he won. He was found not guilty. Hence, 37 additional independent papers began to be published in the colonies, each one with a right to be critical of the monarchy and what they saw as wrong. And then in 1739, there was a seminal moment where America could have really done the right thing. There was the failure to end slavery. But it began the beginning of the abolitionist movement. And all the great abolitionists throughout history, in the United States at least, it was done much earlier in England, Blackthorpe over there, you can thank that time. There was an uprising down in South Carolina. And some of the slaves decided they want to be free. And there were 32,000 blacks living in South Carolina at that time. And a man named Cato, C-A-T-O, led a small group, I think it was under 20 slaves, down towards Florida, where they were challenged, and 21 whites were killed, and 50 blacks, and then that began the militias. Now, you've heard of a militia, right?
No.
Militias were small groups of individuals who were supposed to protect, but the reason they were started then was because to protect whites against blacks. And that's also when the big plantations began to be built, mainly sugar or tobacco plantations. And then we had some real, real evangelical named George Whitefield who came here, and he had what was called the Great Awakening. It was just one of these evangelical moments where America was not terribly religious at the time, and he galvanized everybody and made them almost, today it would be like a true believer, a rapturist. That didn't last all that long. And then in 1750, England made another stupid act. It was called the Iron Act. And that was to restrain all businesses from having any foundries. Well, the top foundries in America at that time were in, about 60 of them were in Pennsylvania, because Pennsylvania had a lot of iron ore. Easy to get, then to melt down and make your own tools, guns, utensils with. England only wanted the iron ore. They didn't want us to make our finished products. They weren't aware of how industrialist we become. And so that was the problem over there. And that's when Benjamin Franklin, who was a major activist, wrote the first slogan. It was a big slogan. It was, visualize a snake that's broken in section. It said, join or die. That was the first American slogan by one of the patriots against the tyranny of what he saw as being a foreign occupier. And that's what they were considered. Much like we are occupiers in Iraq and Afghanistan and some of Pakistan, so too did we view in America the British as occupiers. Not everybody, however. And then in 1760, there was a man named James Otis. You ever heard of him?
Nope.
He was fighting for the security of people in their homes. He believed that you should not be taxed without proper representation, and that's where that whole concept came along. And it was also the first American lawyer to argue in court the doctrine of natural law, which was the foundation of the Bill of Rights, meaning you should not allow anyone to come in your home and search it and seize anything against you. That was called unreasonable search and seizure. That became the basis of the Fourth Amendment. And then in 1765, you had the Stamp Act, where the English decided, because they were so in debt with the because of the war with France, and that they and the French and English Indian Moors, that they wanted Americans to pay for it. So they made a stamp on everything, a birth certificate package, every legal document. Well, we became enraged by that. They finally repealed that. And it was Patrick Henry, a real patriot from Virginia, who said, let's repeal the Stamp Act. And they got all the colonists together in New York City, and they began to attack tax collectors. And hence, Parliament repealed that. And then in 1774, you had the Quartering Act. Now, Quartering Act meant that, and that led to the Third Amendment, the sanctity of a person's home, where if you were stationed in the United States as a British soldier, the people had to bring you into their home and make you a part of that home. And so that outraged the colonists. And then in 1774, you had the Minutemen militia, and they created what were called Liberty Poles. And these were poles that you would plant in every town, and on it people would hang the British in effigy, or they would put posters or graffiti, and the British would go right behind, and or the soldiers, and tear them down. And then in Concord, Massachusetts, you had the first Minutemen, and on April the 19th, 1775, the British troops marched towards Concord, disarmed the colonies. They didn't want them having guns. Well, guess what that led to? Second Amendment, the right to bear arms. And as Thomas Jefferson said, which is the most accurate understanding, the reason you really need arms is because ultimately it's your government that is going to be that which is most likely to be your enemy. And there were 70 patriots that met at Lexington. They were grossly outnumbered. About 10 were killed. But that became the Battle of the American Revolution. It lasted a long time. Ended in Yorktown. Now, then what happened is this. Then we ended up with the beginning of this whole movement for a Bill of Rights. You had in 1774 the First Continental Congress. They met in Philadelphia. And from September 5th to October 26th, you had representatives, not all the colonies, 12 colonies, and Patrick Henry from Virginia, he said, I'm not a Virginian, I'm an American. And suddenly there was this rallying call, we are Americans, and we're not from a state. And they acted for the first time as a United States. And then we had the Declaration of Independence, which preceded the Constitution. That was in 1776. Remember this, to hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, and went on, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, that is then. Then, by the spring of 1776, many colonists from New York and Pennsylvania and New Jersey, they opposed a lot of things that were going on, and so they wanted a real constitution, and they got one. And then we ended up ending our wars in 1786. The war had been over 5 years. We did have some rebellion. Shays' Rebellion showed the need for a new constitution. And that was based upon a Captain Daniel Shays, who led an uprising in western Massachusetts with farmers. And then they created the Articles of Confederation, which governed the new United States. And then finally what this all comes down to is two documents, Claire, Kara. The document is the Constitution in 1787, Philadelphia, and chaired by George Washington, and the delegates to the Constitution. That's where the preamble of the Constitution, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect unit, establish justice and ensure the domestic tranquility and provide for the common defense and promote the general welfare and security of the blessings of liberty to yourself and ourselves and our property, to order this Constitution of America. But there were several articles that followed, creating the three government branches and establishing, you know, the article. Each article was important. Article 3 established judiciary power, the Supreme Court and lesser courts. And then you end up with some people called anti-federalist. These were the people, like James Madison and others, and Alexander Hamilton, who believe, don't give all the power to the Constitution. What if this Constitution, what if this federal government ends up being bad? That's not a good thing. So we need to make sure that the Constitution of the United States, that the federal government, never has more power over the people than what it should, and that the states also have some sovereignty. So the question was, how much power should the federal government have? And the idea was to protect the rights of the citizens. The anti-federalists demanded a Bill of Rights. So in 1789, Alexander Hamilton, who was our first Secretary of the Treasury, and others, set into motion what we should have. And that's what's important, because it's the Bill of Rights that anyone today should be focused on. And those Bill of Rights are the rights that you can assemble, a freedom of speech, the right to people to gather, to redress their government. Okay, let's just take that one. When you go to Washington, D.C., as Chris Hedges, and about 180 people did, and they redressed their government, and they went in front of it, nonviolently, unarmed, what happened? They were all arrested. Who was president? Barack Obama. Did he come out and say, I'm a constitutional professor, and therefore you are actually engaging your rights? No. And what also happened? Every one of those people will have an intelligence agency analysis done. They will all now be on watch list. They will be considered terrorists. Each person in the United States who protests based upon their absolute Bill of Rights are now considered enemy of the state. There are no exceptions. Any human being that opens their mouth in the United States in a public forum is now on an enemy's list. Does that sound like a good thing to you, Carolee?
No.
Well, that is what is being violated. And that is what the Patrick Henrys and the people who are the anti-federalists believed. Also, one of the very important amendments, the Sixth Amendment, is a speedy trial. The ability to confront your witnesses in an impartial jury. Do we have that today?
No.
No, we do not. Why don't you ask that young gentleman who is now being held without trial, without knowing the charges against him, without the ability to have counsel. Look at all the detainees at Guantanamo. Look at all the rendition sites that we're doing today. The United States under Barack Obama, and specifically the President of the United States today, asked for permission to be able to assassinate any person that he and his delegates deem a threat to the United States, without trial, without any laws, without any evidence except someone's belief that that person represents a threat. Do you believe the President of the United States should have the ability to kill anyone they want anywhere at any time for any reason that he chooses?
No.
He's got that power. Did you know that? Did anyone know that? Gee whiz, the left hasn't said a damn thing about this. It's as if the people on the left mockingly and with gross dismissiveness challenge anyone who is actually standing up for some rights. Wonder when someone is going to stand up for the rights that have been so abused. I want to tell you something. I could go through each and every one, because I know each and every one of the Bill of Rights. I know the Constitution. I know the Federalist Papers. I actually study. And I'm offended by how we have denigrated ourselves to become a nation without the rights that once would have made any of the signers of the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights angry. Today, virtually all of the signers of the Declaration of Independence would be on an enemy's watch list, would be considered terrorist, would be arrested repeatedly, their cell phones would be monitored, their emails read, their mail read, they would have targets on them at all times, every member of the original signer of the Declaration of Independence and the founding of our country. What does Glenn Beck and any of these people have in common with them? How about nothing? Nothing. Has Glenn Beck ever gone out and protested in front of the White House and let himself be arrested? He has not. Nor has Sarah Palin. In fact, they support the very tyranny that we are now manifesting. My God, how low have we come? Thank you, Carolee.
Thank you, Gary.
Let's say hello to a person who's going to be starting her own program tomorrow on the Progressive Radio Network, Allison Rose Levy. She's been a journalist covering the health field for a long time. She writes now for the Huffington Post, as well as Change.org and Psychology Today and Urban Zen. Nice to have you with us.
It's great to be with you, Gary, and it's great to be on Progressive Radio Network. I'm so delighted to be beginning the show tomorrow. It's called Connect the Dots. And it's going to be on at noon Eastern time on Saturdays. So I've just been listening to your program up till now, and I just have to say, as a over 25-year journalist in the major media and covering health, how proud I am to be, on this network helmed by you, and your statements about the current tragedy of journalism and our loss of freedom of information, and therefore the shaping of public attitudes across a whole spectrum of things. I completely agree with you, and it's these kinds of things as well that we'll be addressing on the show.
Excellent. Well, we look forward to hearing you tomorrow. I'm on the road, but I'll be listening over the Internet.
Okay,
great. Have a great inaugural show tomorrow.
Thank you so much, Gary.
Okay, and that is Allison Rose Levy, whose show starts tomorrow on the Progressive Radio Network. Now, I'm going to begin a commentary from one of our listeners, Christina D'Amico. I don't know if I'll have time to finish it on some of our land-based stations. Whatever you don't hear, you can read the full article by going to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. It is called, Can We Fix Our Failing Schools? I will complete it on Progressive Radio Network, but I understand some of our stations have to cut out in a few minutes. But please go there and read it. It's very informed. And I will be reading on a weekly basis the email commentaries that you offer about issues that you find important, you're willing to do some research and scholarship on, and write us the problem and the solution. This is from Christine D'Amico. Today I was teaching in a general education fifth grade class in New York City public school system. I went around and listened to each student and read individually. At least 45% of the students in this class suffer from a lack of ability to decode, meaning sounding out the words. In addition, about 85% of these students lack a wide breadth of vocabulary knowledge. Research proves that the inability to read fluently, along with vocabulary deficits, results in low comprehension. Therefore, a significant portion of this class is at risk. I then did a math lesson on equivalent fractions, which was riddled with questions that were beyond these kids' understanding. I had to tell these frustrated students the answers because they simply could not do their work independently. About 85% of these students don't know the multiplication and division tables. None of them can write correctly in cursive. Their ability to write essays, even to put together a coherent paragraph, is below grade level. Yet, all these students passed the fourth grade state test last year, indicating that these tests are obviously dumbed down, and test grading is curved, and that is a tragedy. Sadly, this evening, I thought, these kids will probably never catch up with their peers in the suburbs, who are themselves behind the rest of the world. Even worse, though, I questioned, where the hell are these kids headed? Dropout, crime, drugs, maybe early pregnancy and poverty? But more importantly, cultural and academic illiteracy, which makes their decision-making and thinking ability substandard. Such is the repetitive cycle in this neighborhood, and this disastrous scenario repeats itself all over the country. And if you think this problem is just in our poor neighborhoods, you're wrong. Who's really responsible for the demise of our schools? Is it the rampant supply of unqualified, unmotivated teachers, as the current media depicts? Is teacher tenure the problem? Are teachers simply too lazy and too secure, thanks to pensions to care? What about state requirements and testing? Is there not enough or too much? Is corruption, the lack of integrity in school districts' leaders, the problem? What about the low requirements in teacher formation? Are colleges who are graduating teachers setting requirements for education degrees too low? Are negligent parents to blame? Is lack of discipline the problem? Are children, for the most part, not able to focus anymore? Are disruptive students the problem? Why are so many children failing and failing through the cracks? Who is really responsible for the demise of our educational system? And most importantly, is it redeemable? In our educational system, if it is restorable, how? Then what can we do to give American students the best education possible? The problem. The most recent results of international cooperative statistics show the U.S. ranks 12th of 24 countries in fourth grade math, 15th in 44 countries out of 44 countries in eighth grade math, and 9th in 35 countries in fourth grade reading. And out of 35 participating countries, the United States students' attitudes towards reading rank third from the bottom, suggesting our children are have little interest in this fundamental subject. Concern is mounting that our students are falling seriously behind other countries. Our talent pool is shrinking because fewer students are majoring in math and science at our universities. Colleges are reporting that more and more students are arriving unprepared, requiring freshmen to retake courses which they should have already mastered in high school. And the areas in need of greatest remediation are reading, writing, and math. For African Americans, Latinos, the statistics are worse yet, as their test scores lag dramatically behind their white and Asian peers. Christopher Jenks and Meredith Phillips, editors of the book Black and White Test Score Gap, point out in their introduction that African Americans score lower than whites on vocabulary, reading, and math tests, as well as on standardized tests such as SAT. This gap appears before kindergarten and persists into adulthood, with the average black student scoring 70-80% below white students of the same age. Similar issues arise when Mexican American and Latino students, as well as Native American students, are compared to white students. Although this phenomena has not been studied as widely, the top gap, known as those of the so-called rich academically get richer and the poor academically get poorer. State tests are being dumbed down. Recently, we learned in New York State that the state tests have been made easier for years, while the Bloomberg administration has been touting high test score gains. Now the state claims it has raised the standards. But who can believe a system that has been lying for years regarding test results? Every state and city designs tests for regional specific results and have little value because there is no standard of comparison. Conversely, norm-referenced standardized testing is more valid because test results could be compared across the nation. Another aspect of the problem is lack of school discipline. Teachers and supervisors are not allowed to discipline students for fear of repercussions from parents. Many teachers are not well-trained in classroom management. Often one or two students create major discipline problems in a class, thereby taking up most of the teacher's prime teaching time. They are told to, quote, just deal with it, often while the administration is mute in a standby position. Our special education classrooms are continuing to fill up, and again, African-American students are being placed more than white students. According to the U.S. Department of Education, African-Americans account for 16% of the student population. However, they represent 32% of the students with mental disabilities in special education. Teachers complain that their parents are not supporting their children's work at home. Indeed, especially students in low-income urban neighborhoods are lacking sorely in parental involvement. In New York City, in general, about 5% of the student population is represented by parent involvement in the schools. That means 95% are not. Even the most active parents, however, don't have their finger on the causes and solutions of dysfunctional schools. They are mainly focused on helping their children survive in a system that is not working. Teacher preparation courses are devoid of academic rigor and research-based reading skills, and while reading is the single most important factor for judging a student's success in school, children are referred to special education classes because they can't read. Teachers rarely get any opportunity to study effective reading instructional methods. The limited phonic awareness programs are abysmal. Teachers without any in-depth knowledge of how to teach reading and spelling are placed in early childhood classrooms where the instruction will either make or break a child's entire academic career. Just as importantly, there are some teachers, such as non-native speakers, placed in these classrooms who have intrinsic and linguistic limitations to the speech sound awareness and understanding of how a child learns by sound. All these problems, however, although essential pieces of the public school puzzle, are small in comparison to the one major cause of our school's demise. And here's the solution: curriculum. That's right. A school's district's choice of curriculum dictates everything teachers say and do. It can even dictate the seating arrangement in the classrooms, whether the students are facing each other or in front of the facing the front of the room, the number of bulletin boards, how they are displayed, and the comments on them, and the use of chalkboards or whiteboards. Everything from what the teachers say to how it is said is dictated solely by the choice of curriculum. Teachers must follow the script or be disciplined. Many curriculums are developed by university professors who have little or no classroom experience and just as little research to back up their work. These professors market and sell their work to publishers, or if they are associated with big institutions such as Columbia University Teachers College or Harvard University, they are usually believed to work without question because the names carry such mighty weight in academia. Oftentimes, this is the case with the failed whole language curriculum from New Zealand. They are created in other countries. Other times, the big publishers use a team or a staff to develop a curriculum and then pay university professors to sign off on their programs. These publisher-designed curriculums are built along current trends and instructional strategies that are in fashion as opposed to empirical research-based design curriculums. Most curriculums are written from an existing paradigm and can basically be categorized into two camps. One is direct, systematic, explicit instruction, such as phonics, while the other is implicit instruction, such as whole language. Direct, systemic, explicit methods are logical, straightforward, and provide much guidance, whereas implicit methods do not provide specific guidance on what is to be learned from the task. The latter is the basic paradigm underlying the failed whole language method. The designers of this method believe students implicitly learn to read with little attention paid to phonics, but it's not true. Both methods are applied not only to reading, but also to writing in math curriculum. There are usually just a handful of alleged experts in charge of buying into the philosophy behind a school district's curriculum. More often than not, these so-called experts have minimal to no classroom experience. Choosing the curriculum for schools can often have little to do with what works and far more to do with whether or not the curriculum is written by a friend or the current trend in academia. These contracts with districts are huge, and publishers are in the business of making money. They often cut deals with big school districts, giving away free books in exchange for these contracts. Publishers in the business of selling and like to come up with new programs. Whether they work or not is immaterial. They're making money. They also like to sell their most expensive programs again to maximize their profit margins. Once a school district buys into a curriculum, no matter how inappropriate or ineffective, teachers must use it without question. Those who question the district's choices are silenced. And if he or she chooses to continue questioning, even though reprimanded, he or she will eventually be disciplined and made an example of by the district. Teachers are not allowed to tell parents that the curriculum chosen is not research-based. They are also not allowed to use any other materials other than the mandated curriculum chosen by the district. When test scores plummet due to poor teaching methods, however, teachers are blamed. With their hands tied and their mouths muted, teachers become the scapegoats, stripped of all power, and therefore unable to make a difference in their children's lives. The real culprit in all these low test scores, though, can be pinned down to the decision makers at the top who are forcing teachers to be quiet and using poorly written curriculums in their classrooms. And finally, however, these individuals are never held accountable before the Board of Education or public for the poor choices they made for our students. When test scores go down, these curriculum directors sit back in their offices without any consequences whatsoever to the choices they've made, the taxpayers' money they've spent, and the results they promised but haven't delivered. Teachers who are on the front lines wind up taking the blame for this mismanagement of power and knowledge. Clearly, there is a disconnect between the decision makers and the consequences of those decisions in our schools. There is more on this. You can read the rest of this. I want to thank you very much, Christine D'Amico, a concerned teacher. I believe you've hit it right on the head. The curriculums are the wrong curriculums for the wrong reasons, and if you don't start with the right curriculums and taught correctly, then everything that falls after that will in itself be a problem. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you very much for being with us today. And now, Danny Schechter, the news dissector.
The Gary Knoll Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride. And the program director is Carol Lee.